Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict expresses his shock and his sadness for the victims of a senseless shooting and for many who lost their lives in a ferry disaster. British MP explains the reasons behind his 5,000-kilometre trek from Olympia in Greece to the Houses of Parliament in London, raising awareness for the Olympic truce, an unimplemented UN resolution. And Vatican Radio's film critic Peter Malone explains why he enjoyed the latest summer blockbuster, Snow White and the Huntsman. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday spoke of his shock and sadness for the deaths of the victims of a senseless shooting in Aurora, Denver, last Friday, and for the loss of life in a recent ferry disaster near Zanzibar, in which at least 68 people died. He assured all of those affected by both tragedies his closeness in prayer. And speaking after the recitation of the Angelus in the courtyard of the papal summer residence at Castel Gandolfo, the Pope also turned his attention to the upcoming Olympic Games in London. Lydia O'Kane reports.
Pope Benedict spoke of his shock on Sunday in what he called the senseless violence that took place in Aurora, Denver, in which 12 people were killed and dozens of others injured when a gunman opened fire during a film screening.
I was deeply shocked by the senseless violence which took place in Aurora, Denver, and saddened by the loss of life in the recent ferry disaster near Zanzibar.
The Holy Father also expressed his sadness at the loss of life in the recent ferry disaster near Zanzibar, in which at least 68 people died. The Pope said he shared the distress of the families and friends of the victims and the injured, especially the children, and he assured all those affected by both tragedies his closeness in prayer. Pope Benedict was speaking after the recitation of the Angelus in the courtyard of the papal summer residence at Castel Gandolfo in the Roman Hills, where he also had words of encouragement for those taking part in the upcoming Olympic Games in London.
I send greetings to the organisers, athletes and spectators alike, and I pray that in the spirit of the Olympic truce, the goodwill generated by this international sporting event may bear fruit, promoting peace and reconciliation throughout the world. I want all those attending the London Olympic Games and invoke the abundant blessings of Almighty God.
Before the Angelus, Pope Benedict took time to reflect on this Sunday's Gospel, in which Jesus is depicted as the Good Shepherd. The Holy Father explained to the faithful gathered that God is the shepherd of mankind who wants to guide us to good pasture, which, he said, is the fullness of life. The Pope went on to say that in today's world, that's what every father and every mother wants for their children, a good life, happiness, achievement.
È quello che desidera ogni padre e ogni madre per i propri figli, il bene, la felicità, la realizzazione.
Jesus, said Pope Benedict, presents himself as the shepherd of the lost sheep of Israel. Among those lost sheep, continued the Pope, are the great saints Mary of Magdala and Luke the Evangelist. The Holy Father explained that the deep healing of God works through Jesus, which consists of true peace and the fruit of reconciliation. Concluding his address, the Pope said that amidst the evil seed of war, God creates peace. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. Nobody can deny the Olympic Games are a big deal. Whether you are a sports enthusiast or not, each time the Olympics come round, you are inevitably caught up in the buzz and the excitement they generate for a number of reasons. And each time they come around, most of humanity watches in awe as the people of the world unite in friendly and peaceful competition. Yes, peace and friendship were the very reasons the games were first held in 776 BC in ancient Olympia, to allow warring Greek city-states to set aside conflict, to celebrate togetherness, to experience peace inspired by sport, to imagine peace. This is the Olympic Truce, an ancient tradition, a peace accord which lasted through more than 1,200 years of ancient history, a truce which has now been revived to offer hope and opportunity for dialogue, encouraging and inspiring all humanity to imagine peace. And to this day, although the Olympic Truce is something that not many people have heard of, it is a United Nations resolution signed by all 193 countries in the world, but implemented by none. That's why Lord Michael Bates, a Conservative MP at the English Parliament, decided to undertake a 5,000-kilometre walk from Olympia in Greece to the Houses of Parliament in London to raise awareness and promote the Olympic Truce and all that it stands for. Speaking to Lydia O'Kane, Lord Bates said that over 10 months of hard walking, he braved searing heat, freezing weather and a broken arm, but also had an audience with the Pope as he took his campaign to schools and politicians as well as athletes.
Well, I got started because I came across a United Nations General Assembly resolution which said that during the period of the Olympic and Paralympic Games, signatories would observe a period of truce and pursue initiatives for peace and reconciliation. And I tried to find out what had happened as a result of these resolutions, which are proposed before every summer and winter games. And I found that although every country in the world signed it, no country in the world had ever implemented it. So I thought, wouldn't it be great for London 2012 if we tried to rediscover what the ancient games were all about?
Have you always been a fan of the Olympic Games? Have you always enjoyed watching the Olympic Games?
Well, I do enjoy the Olympic Games, but my interest was really a historical one that I hadn't appreciated, and many of your listeners might not appreciate, that when we seem to think that the Olympics are all about highly paid athletes, big broadcasting deals and multinational sponsors, that actually their original purpose was peace, to bring fighting men together from different city-states, uniting them as Olympians, and helping them to have sporting competition rather than killing each other. And I thought that was an amazing vision back in 776 BC, and we haven't quite seemed to have recaptured that vision in 2012.
So would that be one of your main goals, to really highlight the peace aspect? But also, what else would you like to see coming out from what you're doing?
Well, I think that a lot of people say that peace is impossible. Now, leaving aside, it's interesting that 3,000 years ago, the Greeks and the Persians could have a period of peace, but we don't seem to be able to manage it. The reality is that here is something which is a UN resolution, so it's fairly serious, of the General Assembly, that everybody, every country in the world has signed. And I think that it would be a good thing if everybody did at least one thing to try and implement, if not the letter, then certainly the spirit of what the truce is about.
How much support have you received from your colleagues in Parliament?
Well, I think that people are fairly sort of sceptical. We live in times which I understand people are worried about security threats, etc. But I often say to them, why is it that we all seem to be able to, when there's a UN resolution that calls for us to engage militarily in another country, often justifiably, why is it that we can muster billions of pounds and international political will and resource behind that? And yet when there's a resolution which every country in the world has signed that actually calls for a period of peace from the 27th of July to the 9th of September this year, we don't seem to be able to take it with any seriousness at all. I think that tells us something about us, and I don't think it's a particularly positive picture of paints.
Do you lament the fact that the Olympic Games outlook might have changed from what it was years and years ago. Is that to you quite a lamentable fact?
Well, it is a fact, and the real cause of that was the way that the modern games were set up as a competition between nations. So everybody comes along and they represent their nation and they want to compete to effectively show national pride and, you know, that one country is better than another. And that reached its most obscene level, obviously, during the 1936 Berlin Games, but also continued during the Cold War. Whereas the ancient games, people, athletes, were not allowed to have any vestige of representation for their city-state. They came together and they competed together as Olympians, and it was an incredible vision. So I think the fact that we have it set up that where people are looking for, you know, cheering on their national athletes rather than the sporting event itself, therein lies a bit of the reason why we find these things so difficult.
I wanted to ask you a bit about the logistics of your walk, especially for our listeners. Where did you start from? Where were you going to?
The original idea of the walk came from the fact that the Olympic truce used to be heralded, announced, by the Olympic torch relay, where the flame was lit in Olympia in Greece, and then it went through lots of different countries on its way to the Games. And for London, for the first time since 1928, they decided to cancel that so that the flame was lit in Greece and then flown to London. And I thought, what a missed opportunity to take the message of peace up through the Balkans, across the battlefields of the First World War, the Second World War, the front line of the Cold War, and then for it to arrive in London. And it seemed to me to be a decision that embodied everything that was wrong about the way that the games are currently configured. And then I thought, well, if they're not going to do it, there's no reason why I can't. And so that's where the decision came from. It was a very spur-of-the-moment thing. And I set off on Good Friday from Olympia and arrived in London 10 months later, having covered 5,000 kilometres.
That's an awful long way. How much preparation did you need for that walk?
I discovered one thing, which was that planning and preparation are much overrated. I think if I'd thought about it a great deal, I probably wouldn't have gone. And it was very much a spur-of-the-moment thing, and within a week or two, I decided to do the walk, went out to the store, bought a rucksack, packed half the wrong things, left at home half the right things, and set off on my own from Olympia to Athens. So it was a very spontaneous thing, and for the first 3 months there really wasn't any interest in it at all, and then there was a change of view on the part of the British government, and they came out and supported the Olympic truce and supported my walk, and that has meant that you know, we really have made quite a lot of progress on the Olympic truce this time around.
I was going to ask you, on your walk, did you use a lot of kind of new media like Twitter or blogs or Facebook to get your message across, to give people an idea where you were and what you were doing?
Yes, I mean, I would faithfully you know, try and find Wi-Fi every night, which wasn't easy in every location where I stayed. And I would update, I took photographs with my digital camera, which had a GPS locator on, and uploaded them on Flickr at Walk for Truce. And every 5 kilometers, a picture would be uploaded showing where I was. But I have to say, probably there wasn't a great deal of interest, because people didn't know what the Olympic truce was. And they didn't know who I was. So it probably wasn't, in that sense, a sort of brilliant initiative for raising publicity. But the important thing was that I did manage to go through 15 countries. I met with the UN Secretary General in Geneva, the President of the International Olympic Committee, the Presidents and Prime Ministers of most of the countries I visited. And most significantly for me as a Christian, had the great honor of being received by His Holiness the Pope at the Vatican. July last year.
I wanted to ask you, for you and for your fellow countrymen, is there a sense of pride that the Games are coming to London?
I think there is a pride, but I think that the what I worry about is that it is seen as such a commercial exercise. People are worried about the cost of it, and then there is the security side. You know, we have pictures every day of surface-to-air missiles being placed around the site and warships sailing up the Thames to protect us. And I think when I see that, it's not that I don't think it's necessary. Probably, sadly, it is necessary. But I thought that perhaps wouldn't it be wonderful if we could rediscover that ancient vision, that this was the world coming together in union, together as Olympians, to celebrate our humanity and what unites us, rather than actually what divides us.
What do you think the Olympic Games stands for? At its core, what do you think the Olympic spirit really is?
Well, I think that the Olympic spirit, as it was originally conceived, was to allow people to come together and recognise that they were no different. They had spent in Athens and Sparta generations upon generation in a perpetual state of war. And just the fact that they could come together and realize that these people who they thought were evil, wicked, terrible people were actually just like them, and that they could meet with them, they could be friends with them, they could compete with them under the same rules, that began to transform our understanding. One of the experiences which I had when I walked across Europe, I got to the end, almost to the end, and I was speaking at a primary school in Brussels, and one of the children asked me this question. They said, "You've walked across 15 countries. Who were the nicest and who were the nastiest?" And I said, that's a great question. I said, "You know what it is? I couldn't tell you the difference. It's as if I walked across one country. Everybody was exactly the same. If you smiled at them, they smiled back. If you asked for directions, they did their best to point you in the right direction. If you asked for accommodation, they asked for 50 euros. Everybody was exactly the same." And I think that's something that we forget because so much of our national pride and national identity is built on the back of saying we are better than the others. They are different to us. We are good. They are evil. And from such things, we see sectarian violence and we see international violence coming forward. And one of the reasons why I started on Good Friday was because when my colleague said to me that truce was just a crazy ideal and it could never actually be brought around in reality, I reminded them that there was a Good Friday agreement signed in 1998. And that brought peace that I never thought I would see in my time in Northern Ireland. This year we saw Her Majesty the Queen shaking hands with a former commander of the terrorist Irish Republican Army. And now, you know, what we often, as I say, miss out on is just the potential for peace. Things don't need to be this way. They can be different. But the starting point for that is that we are all the same. There is absolutely no difference between us. We are all the same. And that is what the Olympics is about. We are all one.
That was Lord Michael Bates, the British MP behind the Walk for Truce campaign. And for more on that interesting campaign and for further details about the Olympic truce, you can click on www.walkfortruce.org. And now Vatican Radio's film critic Peter Malone talks about some light entertainment that he thinks could well become a summer blockbuster. The film is called Snow White and the Huntsman, and as Peter explains, no expense has been spared in the production. Settings are quite spectacular, from the formidable castle and its vast interiors, The wave-crashing sea and the beach expanses, a deadly forest and the beauty of a fairyland.
My queen, yet another kingdom falls to your glory. Is there no end to your power?
I enjoyed it. I suppose that's a good thing to say first. We've had an abundance of Snow White during 2012. So Snow White appeared first in Mirror Mirror with, well, it was a star vehicle for Julia Roberts as the Wicked Queen. And it was more than a touch tongue-in-cheek, quite spectacular in castles and costumes and some of the monsters in the woods, and a romance with Prince Charming being put under a spell by the Wicked Queen. So that came, popular enough, I think, but I was expecting something a bit in the same vein with this one, but not at all. This one is quite serious, over 2 hours in length, and really quite spectacular to look at, and epic music, so it's got all the build-up for, Northern Hemisphere summer blockbuster.
I was interested to read that the director, Rupert Sanders, has had a career in commercials, and that really comes out in the movie, doesn't it?
I think one of the things that commercials directors are able to do is to fit in a whole lot of even narrative, but detail, you know, in about 15 seconds, because they need to have everything done, you know, within 30 seconds or 60 seconds, so they make every second count. And this was occurring to me during this film. It's filled with detail, and the narrative keeps moving fairly rapidly. So I think he's brought that kind of skill to bear and engages his audience and amazes them with the amount of detail as well.
I should have killed her when she was a child.
I need her heart beating with blood.
Also, Charlize Theron in the role of the Evil Queen seems to be enjoying herself.
Well, she does, except she doesn't smile much during it because she is evil personified.
Do you hear that? It's the sound of battles fought and lives lost. It once pained me to know that I am the cause of such despair. But now, their cries give me strength.
She's certainly very beautiful, and at the beginning of the film when she starts Mirror Mirror, the mirror, of course, is quite honest in saying she's beautiful.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is fairest of them all?
You are the fairest, but there is...
But I think Charlize Theron might have enjoyed doing the role because as it goes on and she gets older, she begins to look older, and so she has to devise ways of keeping young. So she actually imprisons some young girls from the countryside and somehow breathes out their youth into herself, and then she renews. And
but no.
Other times she goes in for milk baths and things like that. But of course, at the end, not to spoil the ending, she has to confront Snow White, of course, and she doesn't win, as we know, and she really looks old by the end of the film.
So, well, her comments during the film that her beauty is her power is actually not a superficial one at all in this time and day.
Beauty is my power.
Well, she's vain. She comes from a poor family, and she tricks herself into the kingdom and marries the king and rather dramatically murders him. I didn't remember that, but yeah, she murders him. And she also has a brother who is kind of in servitude towards her, so he does everything and all her dirty work for her, including pursuing Snow White when he leaves himself open to be attacked by her in her prison cell, and she's found a nail on the wall outside the castle and attacks him with it and then runs away. So the queen, of course, not very happy, sends him out to find someone to find Snow White, and that is the huntsman.
Find me someone who doesn't fear the dark forest to hunt her down.
Played by Chris Hemsworth, who actually comes from Melbourne.
If I refuse...
I thought I could hear an Australian accent there. There's a lot of computer intervention into the film, which is, as you said, very spectacular. But how about the actors who have been computerized to become dwarves? What do you think about that?
Well, I noticed that the Association of Small People were not very happy at all, and they said that the acting parts should have been given to dwarves and small people instead of getting some very celebrated British actors like Ian McShane and Bob Hoskins and Eddie Marsan to become the dwarves.
You have eyes, huntsman, but you do not see. She is destined to lend the darkness.
Somebody then pointed out that Sanders was skillful enough not to waste money on computerising them always, but often just to film them from the neck up so that they could just be themselves. But they're a funny little group. There are eight of them at first, and then one dies, and then there were seven. But they join with the huntsmen and trek throughout the countryside, raising up armies from the exiled duke so that they can attack the queen and the castle. And it becomes one of those medieval epics and battles with boiling oil and fiery arrows and fireballs and things like that. So towards the end, it gets very much into the action vein, and there's Snow White wearing armour, and of course everybody thinks of Joan of Arc as she attacks the castle.
We haven't mentioned Snow White. Yeah. She's the star at the moment of Hollywood, isn't she? It's Kirsten Stewart.
Who are you? Why is the queen once
you're
dead?
You should know you're the one hunting me!
Yes, I'm not sure that she was as good as all that. I've seen her in a couple of other films which reassure me that she can act. A little film called Welcome to the Rileys, where she plays a strip dancer in New Orleans. She's actually very good in that. And she was playing Joan Jett, the singer-writer, in The Runaways, so she can act. But when she's in the Twilight films, and in this one, she tends to be kind of mono-expression in some ways. She's a sturdy heroine, one might say, but not as inspiring as I might have thought.
Okay, so you say it's action entertainment. Having seen the trailer, I certainly won't take my child to see it.
No, it's a darker portrait of Snow White, and it's not the exact kind of romance that you think, with the Prince Charming, Prince William, and the Huntsman. I think they're more interested in characters and actions and just bringing the fairy tale to life in a 21st century blockbuster kind of way. So if that appeals, then it's good, but it might not be, for all the serious-minded moviegoers. Might be better for the holiday season.
Lips red as blood, hair black as night. Bring me your heart, my dear. Dear Snow White, let them come.
You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.